So welcome back to the Religious Studies Project. We are still stuck on a train heading up to Edinburgh. By we, I mean Rachel, Chris and I. And we are still stuck drinking Stella Artois for our sins. And we're on the way back from the Socrel conference, which we talked about last week.
This week, we have an interview with Chris Duncan, our pal.
Yeah,
over another pile over in the States. We're collecting them, and we're hoping, fingers crossed, that he is coming to Edinburgh next year, though maybe you shouldn't mention that. But I just have, so...
Well,
we can still be hoping that he's coming, whether he's intending
to or not. And he spoke to Winifred Sullivan, who's a major figure in the States, on the subject of religion and the law.
And this forms the final podcast of our... what we called religion in secular society. So we had religion in the media, spiritual tourism, and religion in the law. So it's that sort of interaction, that liminal state.
And I've just realised that if next week we put out the religion in the news panel that we just recorded, then that can form a fourth part of the series.
Topping and Italian, a media sandwich.
Nice.
Good.
Let's do that. Okay. So hey, that's scheduling live on your iPod
right now. Over to Chris Duncan.
Hello, my name is Chris Duncan. With me today is Professor Winifred Sullivan, professor and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Indiana University. Professor Sullivan is here at Arizona State University giving a lecture called Ministries of Presence, Chaplains as Priests of the Secular. So, firstly, Professor Sullivan, welcome to Arizona. Great rainy weather, which is the only weekend this year that's actually going to occur. The talk yesterday wasn't what I thought it was going to be when I signed up for it, frankly. It was much more interesting than I was anticipating. As a religious studies student here in the U.S., talking about chaplains is usually something that doesn't arise very often just because of the... faux secular nature of what we're trying to do, I guess, is the best way of saying it, bracketing out our ideas and our own personal beliefs. The best way to start off, I would assume, would be just the talk on the chaplaincy. Your lecture yesterday focused on chaplaincy within secular settings, federal prison system, U.S. Wildlife Service, I think, is one of the examples that you gave.
It's actually the Maine.
Oh, the Maine.
The state of Maine, yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
And federal hospitals as well. I actually had a long conversation with some friends about that last night.
Yes.
The licensure for hospitaling that requires a chaplain service, which is quite interesting. In specific regards to your lecture, is there any further detail that might be necessary? Would you like to give a 2 to 3 minute summary of what your lecture kind of went over in the 45 minute grandiose scale that it was?
Well, perhaps I could say that I too would have thought before I started working on this that chaplaincy would be a rather dull topic. And in fact, I think when I tell people that I'm writing a book about chaplains, their eyes begin to glaze over. What I have learned is that chaplains, or thinking about chaplains, is actually turned out to be a very useful way for me to think beyond the work I've done criticizing, critiquing constitutional and international legal protection for religious freedom. And my critique has largely been the instability and incoherence of the category of religion as a basis for legal regulation. And this is now a well-worn topic in religious studies. Although I find it interesting that many religious studies scholars who are very happy to trash the category of religion as an academic matter remain themselves committed to something they call religious freedom, even though that combination of positions seems incoherent to me. In any event, putting aside then the management of religion in modern secular societies at sort of constitutional level and getting down in the weeds, which I think is actually much more interesting. In other words, how do religion and law shape each other on the ground? So what I have discovered in the course of working on this book is that in the U.S. context, in many kinds of institutions, governmental, quasi-governmental, and private, chaplains have come to serve a role of ministering to what is increasingly understood in the United States to be a universal spiritual need, and has been a kind of naturalization of religion. How's that to start?
That's great. And actually, that last sentence was perfect, because the metaphor that was used several times throughout your talk, and the one that struck deepest to my heart, was the MASH reference from the TV show centered around the Korean War. I would have to assume that the majority of American youth have seen at least one or two episodes of the show, and I could imagine that most of our international audience has seen at least clips somewhere along the lines. Most of the time, our attention is drawn to Hot Lips Houlihan and Hawkeye and the brash male characters in the big fight scenes and going through these tumultuous moments in time. Yet there's this character in the background, the chaplain, who, in reality, looking back now, as a religious studies scholar, was a Catholic priest, and nothing more than that. Yet, both in mid-century, mid-20th century American culture, we see the white collar, and we recognize, I guess, at its face, the attachment to a particular denomination or a particular ecclesiastical society, but with the requirement placed upon that same person to be able to quite literally minister or provide, as you put in your lecture, a presence to soldiers, to a group of people that may only have that one face to speak to. And that person may not be actually of their own religious cut of cloth, I guess we could say. During your lecture, you also bring up the anecdote of the federal prison chaplain who must be licensured under state policies, yet fully capable of operating on a spiritual level. And I think the way that you mentioned it was they're in a bit of an ambiguous power structure or power struggle between the secular and the state. Could you elaborate any more on perhaps the central figure that you're talking about, this religious person who is expected to provide religiosity or spirituality, but within a, quote, secular setting, if that's even possible?
Well, of course it's possible. It happens every day. But no. I think it's helpful to remember that the figure of the chaplain in at least Christian history in the Western churches of Europe and the colonial extension of those churches has always been a sort of in-between or ambiguous figure. And what you describe as a power struggle, I would actually describe more as an issue of split of ambiguous authority lines, that the chaplain is someone, and has always been since the medieval chaplaincies, a a minister who is sort of detailed away from the church. In other words, not operating in the direct line of or chain of command in a sort of military sense. He's away from the bishop, if you're talking about the Catholic, or whoever's in charge of him. And he's away from the demands, the sort of humdrum dailiness of a congregation, if you're thinking in a more kind of Protestant sense. And so, on the one hand, there's that ambiguous connection to the sending religious community. On the other hand, the chaplain has a somewhat ambiguous role in the institution in which they work, because you know, whether they're in, they're not a doctor in a hospital, they're not a prison guard, they're not a soldier, they are a kind of broker, as I describe it, between sacred and secular for these reasons. On the other hand, they're paid by the secular institution, and they have to answer to that authority. And there are many examples in literature and in history of chaplains being captured by the secular mission, the nationalism, if we're talking about the military, but other the secular mission of the institution in which he or she works. I think that people are drawn to chaplaincy partly because they like the ministry in this context, which is kind of like being an emergency room doctor. You know, I think you have to have a kind of get a kind of charge out of these set of ambiguities encountering a stranger. You know, whether in war, a hospital room, or wherever, in an airport, and in a crisis situation in a city, a national disaster. That's also where chaplains work, and making it up in that moment what it means to offer services or spiritual care. Is that what you had in
mind? That's perfect. And that's perhaps the best way to distill my surprise and pleasure at the topic. Is we have this preconceived notion of the chaplain. He sits over here, and, you know, in the hospital, and he marries people, and he divorces people, and he baptizes babies, or she, I guess. And we never really consider perhaps the human being behind the collar or behind the office itself, and almost a psychological profile of someone who would be drawn to that type of work is extremely fascinating, specifically because of those purposes. They are perhaps emotionally or mentally on par with a doctor or someone who responds well under pressure, but they don't pick up a weapon, or they don't pick up a syringe. They pick up a holy text, or they pick up someone's hand. They seem to be, and this sounds a bit probably hyperbolic, but they're almost, to me, the friend that you would always want to have, because they know to a minimum level how to help people in some of their most dark hours of their existence sometimes.
Yes, so I think that it's important to focus on how this role has changed in the last 50 years since Father Mulcahy
exactly.
In MASH. So this a form of encounter that you're describing, what is described by chaplains today as a ministry of presence, is a kind of stripped down form of witness, if you like, using a Christian word, but more existentially basic than that. A sort of suffering with or sitting with is the way it's described. And so the shift that has happened is from a perception that chaplains in mid-century the U.S., but also in other places, had a kind of bag of tricks that was specific to their particular religious and they were there to provide them. And this is particularly the case with Catholic priests, because it is believed by non-Catholics that, you know, Catholic priests, only Catholic priests can do certain things, and that Catholics will go to hell if they don't have those things that the priest gives. And so the priest is sort of dispenser of sacraments and necessary sacraments. But then also at mid-century in the U.S., the kind of reduction of American religious diversity to the Protestant, the Catholic, and Jew meant that those three chaplains are the ones that we see in stories of, in World War II movies, in also in the Korean War. And they are each representing their own religious communities in quite a full way, although they do switch hit for each other. And you know, care for each other's religious congregants. But we've moved to something which is far more generalized, and in which, for one thing, there are not enough Catholic priests to do all the sacramental ministry that is imagined in this early model, but also what the chaplain does now is much less identified with a particular religious tradition. And in fact, the ministry of presence is distinguished by the fact that of non-imposition of any kind of religious identity, so that when the chaplain encounters you, what you describe, the friend you need, the chaplain is trained and understands that to be a non-impositional presence, and to let you take the lead in terms of any kind of religious specificities concerned.
Perhaps changing tact a bit broadly, one of the major mental images that I was aware of while listening to your lecture yesterday was the imposition in the particularly U.S. penal system and the federal prison system of prisoner rehab. One would have to assume that the chaplaincy as such must remain removed from the general prison system itself. Yet at the same time, what I was really making connections with was actually a documentary that I've seen, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 months ago, called Dahmer Brothers, where they essentially, I think it's in Alabama, a group of Zen Buddhist masters create this rehab space, almost, or a safe space for these violent offenders to kind of ground themselves or center themselves. With this in mind, and then with the implied separation of church and state that the majority of the Western world likes to at least put up as a front, could we draw conclusions between groups of this nature who are trying to quite literally rehabilitate?
I wrote a book about prisons.
Right.
Right. Prisons are very specific context. In the U.S., there are, you know, state prisons and federal prisons, and they're all different. There's 51 different jurisdictions in the United States, the criminal jurisdictions, and then there are many prisons and jails at the municipal and county level. These prisons have very differing policies with respect to the accommodation of the religious needs of prisoners. But you could say that chaplaincies in prisons, for the most part, although they operate on different models, are there to provide services on demand for prisoners.
Non-denominational religious expression is, I think, a term that might have been used in your lecture.
I don't think I ever
spiritual,
used
spiritual, secular, not religious kind of idea.
I'm sure I said spiritual, not religious. I'm sure,
right.
I did not say non-denominational, because I don't say that.
Okay.
But I wanted to say one thing about your remarks, which is separation of church and state is not something that's ever been the fact in the United States,
right,
or anywhere. It is a particular sort of political myth about America that was created in the 19th century, and it's been argued partly in reaction to Catholic immigration. So, and that with the mainstreaming of Catholics, it's basically over in terms of any kind of general political motivation in this country. We don't need to separate them because they're now like us. But we were trying to separate them for a while.
Right.
That didn't work either. So I don't think separation of church and state is the model to think about. I think the concern, and I think this would be fairly widely shared in the U.S., is non-imposition. And so that's how it would be we would be distinguished from non-coercive, non-impositional, voluntary religious activity is what distinguishes, I think, for most Americans across the political and religious spectrum, what we're up to politically and legally. But just to say one more thing about prisons, the United States has the highest percentage of incarcerated citizens in the world by a lot. It's way ahead of some other countries we usually don't like to be compared to. And massive incarceration is a huge American scandal. So this is combined with very low spending on rehabilitation generally, and that has declined in the last 20, 30 years. So prison, and also the privatization of social services. So prisons are reliant to a large extent on both voluntary and contract rehabilitation programs. And there are such programs that are done by all religious communities. So the one you suggest, I've read about it also by the Buddhist monks, that's one of them, but all religious communities are provide these kinds of things to prisons of various kinds. Some of them are paid for and some of them are voluntary, and it would be really hard to generalize about them.
Right.
But there's plenty of religion in prisons. Prison superintendents like religion. It gives people something to do, and it may be a way of providing rehabilitation services which the prison itself can't afford to provide, including reentry. I mean, I would say reentry is much more, I should say this, I mean, in terms of where we are with prisons right now, is that the focus, both by reformers of all kinds, is on reentry more than in prison. So, and so these reentry programs, because many prisoners in this country are simply given a bus ticket when they leave prison. They find themselves unable to work because there's so many laws that prevent them from working, getting a driver's license, voting. I mean, so they're hugely hobbled by the law as soon as they get out of prison. And it's that interface that people are working on now, both religious groups and non-religious groups.
That's interesting. I would like to hear more about that, actually. Excellent. Well, thank you, Professor Sullivan. I appreciate all of your time today.
You're welcome.
So you've just been listening to Chris Duncan speaking to Winifred Sullivan there. Rachel, you've also been listening to us. You're in a very privileged position. You're the first.
Well, you're sitting looking at the pair of us across it. That's pretty privileged.
A glorious sight.
Yes. Yeah.
But how have you found your insights into the inner machinations of the Religious Studies Project?
When my eyes adjusted to the beauty before me, I was very entertained by the ways in which you both embody your podcast personalities, the physical and vocal adjustments that occur to embody these podcast personalities is very interesting to observe.
Interesting that you should say that they're embodied, because we've obviously just come out of a conference about material religion and embodiment, rematerialization.
It may be on my mind a little bit.
I wouldn't be surprised if we are mentioning the material aspects of interviews for weeks to come.
I'm certainly thinking that that line more. Yeah.
I wonder if you take on specific train personalities as opposed to your general pub radio personalities to engage with the material surroundings.
It's a viable research question.
It is.
But we will have to come up with a methodology to assess that.
I would personally be very happy if we had the money to sponsor a postgrad to do a research project based on our varying personas.
I would like to assume that these personas will involve a lot of time spent in pubs, and as such, I would like to volunteer my time to observe your personas developed in a variety of pubs, of course. We'd want a wide sampling.
You need a wide... Mm-hmm. You need the sampling to be over a wide area, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. No. But in terms of other news, I mean, Rachel has been involved in another one of the things that we recorded whilst at Subcrill. Hence it's good to be able to introduce you now so that your readers and listeners will be accustomed to your dulcet tones.
Of course.
We recorded a roundtable discussion with George Alanides, who everyone should have heard in our previous podcast, which came from Sydney on academic publishing.
And who pretty much owned the conference. I think his paper was...
But the only theoretical paper.
Yeah, it was very good indeed. And it was a great boon to have him at the panel, at our roundtable, talking about material religion, seeing as he actually knew what he was talking about. Mm. We recorded some interviews as well.
Yes. I interviewed Dr. Abby Day firstly, her whole thesis on the place of belief in the modern world, and particularly on the sort of mismatch between census results and apparent religiosity. And then also she gave us some input from her other hat, which is a sort of good coach in terms of funding and publications and opportunities and jobs and all of that. So we're very grateful for that. David, you also did an interview?
With Martin Stringer, on situational belief, which I don't know which is going to come out first, whether it'll be the roundtable or my Martin Stringer interview, but it'll be clear to the listeners that the question of belief is something very pertinent to me at the moment.
Mm.
But that's a really good interview. It was one of those ones where it came out, because we chose a very specific little topic, and you know, it's 25 minutes, but we cover quite a lot of ground and quite a lot of big sort of theoretical issues within that. I was pleased with that one.
Wonderful.
And Martin's a lovely guy, so it's nice.
Yeah. And then I also interviewed Dr. Peter Collins of Durham University, who's an anthropologist, about religion and the built environment, sort of really tying into the themes of the conference there. And there's a lot of interesting sort of illustrative examples from Quakerism in there, which hasn't really come up in the podcast so far, so it's good to have those examples in there too.
Cool. And as we mentioned earlier, I think we've pretty much decided that the religion and the media panel that we did at Socrill, it's going to be the next podcast, so we've talked about that already, so
we'll not labour that point too
exactly,
much.
Exactly, yeah.
Check us out, amazon.com, amazon.co.uk, iTunes, Twitter, Facebook, all the things. And as per usual...
All the stuff about things and things about stuff?
The things about stuff and the stuff about things. sorry, we have to cite Marion Bowman.
Yeah.
There's that. And for now, I think all we've got to say from this train, which is getting ever closer to Edinburgh...
Thanks for listening.